Meeting of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee will come to order at 1:33 p.m. We are in Belch Room 105. Today is Wednesday, January 25th, 2023. Members present are Senator Merrick, Vice Chair Bishop. Senator Gray Jackson is excused. Senator Dunbar and myself, Senator Bjorkman. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please turn off or silence your cell phones. I'd like to recognize our LIO moderators, Doug Bridges and Zach Lawthorne. Today we will begin our exploration of workforce issues in Alaska and continue that with trade groups. With us this afternoon, we have Jared Kozin with the Alaska Hospital and Healthcare Associations and Karen McIntyre with the South Central Foundation to describe the workforce challenges they are seeing in the healthcare industry. First up, we will hear from Jared Kozin from AHA. Jared, will you please join us at the podium? AHA's mission is to advance the shared interests of Alaska healthcare to build innovative, sustainable system for all Alaskans. For 70 years, the Alaska Hospital and Healthcare Association has served as a nonprofit trade association representing Alaska's hospitals, nursing homes, and other healthcare partners across the continuum of care. AHA members play an invaluable role, both as community providers and essential employers in cities, towns, and villages across the state. AHA provides policy and advocacy expertise, leads and hosts opportunities for education and training, and brings together members and stakeholders for collective work to share data, resources, and best practices. Founded in 1953, AHA was formerly known as the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association, or ASHNA. In May 2022, the board passed a resolution to change the association's name in an effort to adopt a more inclusive, concise, and relevant title to represent our members, or their members, and mission. Jared, thank you for joining us today. Please state your name for the record.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jared Kozin, and as you stated, I'm the President and CEO of the Alaska Hospital and Healthcare Association.
Very well. And would you prefer the panel ask questions as you go through your presentation or wait till the end?
During the presentation, please, Mr. Chair.
Very good.
Shall we take it from here?
Please begin.
All right. Thank you, sir. Again, Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to be here. I'm going to talk about Alaska's healthcare workforce today. And really, I'm going to talk about what we would categorize as our workforce problem. And I really appreciate the chair introducing our association. And as he stated, we've been around Alaska for 70 years. We have the privilege of representing all of Alaska's hospitals, nursing homes, and other healthcare partners across the continuum. And as you can imagine, working with the front lines, when we hear about issues, it's our job to come in and kind of talk to policymakers and others on how to solve them. And the issue we're going to talk about today is workforce. And to do that, I'm going to start in this presentation to establish the context. We're going to talk about the healthcare industry, what the footprint actually looks like in Alaska. And from there, we'll go to the worker shortage. And to understand the worker shortage, we're going to kind of show you that healthcare is an ecosystem. And it's not one or two jobs defining everything. It's a much broader system. And within that system, we're growing and we have a lot of needs. And from there, we'll kind of go down into what's the most dominant position? You know, what are we identifying as our need? And how are the shortages around it affecting it? From there, we'll kind of circle to the consequences of all this. What does it mean? Everyone's having issues with worker shortages across all industries. What does that look like in healthcare and why should it matter? And then we'll end with a couple of recommendations. All the information today we're talking about flows from the statistics and the analysis put together in our Alaska Healthcare Workforce Analysis. That report is the second iteration we've ever done. It was done by Raincoast Data right here in Juneau. And it's an analysis of Department of Labor statistics. So we took the numbers and asked, what do the numbers tell us? And we're going to show you that today. Before I proceed, are there any questions I can answer? Okay, let's jump in. So the industry footprint. When you look at healthcare in Alaska, it's important to know that we pay out about $3 billion in direct wages, which is more than any sector in Alaska. That means we're responsible for 12% of all workforce earnings and that means we're outpacing military and the natural resource sectors. From that, that means we account for about 43,000 jobs, which is 11% of Alaska's workforce. That's second only to the retail, wholesale, trade sector. And I say this and put this slide up here, and it's a double-edged sword, and I recognize that, and we recognize that. We want to say the cost of healthcare is too high. It's too expensive. And we would not argue against that. And that's where a lot of energy has to go, and how do you bring healthcare costs down? I say that on this slide because a lot of people would see this and say, look, how dare you put this up and talk about the industry and the economy? You're a drag on the economy. Healthcare is too expensive. Well, healthcare is too expensive. We need access to healthcare services. That will never go away. And while we need access to services, we need people to provide those services. And that is the point here, is we have a lot of jobs because we have a lot of need. And those are good paying jobs. And that takes us into, what do those jobs look like and why are they important to Alaska? And they're important to Alaska because as we struggle with how do you create opportunities for younger Alaskans to stay home, but to be challenged in a career and a career that's well paying. And we would argue that healthcare is just that. Every single position in healthcare in Alaska is projected to grow. Every one of them. And I know there's your brain, a lot of people will naturally go to, when you hear healthcare, you think doctor and nurse. That's it. That is what healthcare is to me. Healthcare is a lot broader than that. And I've said it earlier, it's more of an ecosystem. If you walk into a hospital, you might see it. You walk in, sure, you're going to see a doctor and a nurse, no doubt. But you're also going to see people cleaning the floors, changing linens over. You're going to see people in the cafeteria, people who are delivering trays of food to rooms. And the reason I kind of touch on all of that is that's clinical, non-clinical jobs, some high paying, some not. But at the end of the day, if any of those positions are lacking, then the whole operation suffers. If you don't have enough people working in the cafeteria, you as a visitor may not get food, but you as a patient may not get food. And if the patient doesn't get food, well, that's not possible. And that shuts everything down. Same thing with people changing linens. If we don't change rooms over fast enough, well, you're going to be stuck in the emergency department for a long time until that room's ready. And if that room doesn't come ready, you get the ripple effect. So it's broader. There's opportunities for everybody, not just someone who wants to be a doctor or a nurse. And that's important because over the next 10 years, the healthcare industry is expected to add 4,500 new jobs, and that's more than any other sector in Alaska. We've had 28% wage growth over a five-year period, and we are ranked number one or number two, first or second highest in the U.S. across 18 categories of healthcare positions. So we're not paying low. And if you were to go to more categories of positions, we generally come in third or fourth. And this is where it kind of gets tricky. You know, I guess those are the positive things to talk about, how impact healthcare can be a positive. Now we start kind of getting into the problems and the negative side of it. And the real problem for us is based on growth and churn, we need to find 7,500 new healthcare workers every year to provide services, okay? That's not as simple as you go to your neighboring facility, your neighboring doctor office, and swipe their front desk person or swipe a nurse or a tech. Because if you do that, you just create another vacancy. So to truly be made whole, to truly provide the services we're required to, we need to find over 7,500 individuals. Of that 7,500, the most dominant position we need are registered nurses. We need to find over 1,500 new recruits every year to provide services. And so if you look at this chart, and this comes from our study, it kind of creates that bullseye effect. You know, the bigger the bubble, the more need you have for that staff. And then wherever it's located will show how we compare to the rest of the country, how we pay, so on and so forth. But that bullseye draws your attention to the registered nurse, and that is because it is the dominant position. So when you look at the dominant position, who's employing it? Hospitals are the largest employer in the healthcare industry. We employ about 30% of all healthcare workers, and we pay about 40% of healthcare wages. And as I just said, what's the largest employee? What's the dominant part of the workforce? It's registered nurses, and we get that. That's what you assimilate with healthcare. Not only are they the highest total number of workers, but they account for 18% of all healthcare wages. Okay, so what you've heard so far, ecosystem, it requires a lot of people to steer the ship. But there's no question that nurses is a huge component of that. And this is where we start getting into the problem. And that's what vacancies are. Alaska is projected, not by us. You can see the source in this chart up here. Alaska is projected to lead the United States in nursing vacancies by 2030 with a 23% shortfall. And so what that's trying to say is by 2030, we're going to be short by about a quarter of our workforce. One in four positions will go open. We can't find someone to fill them. So that is what we're looking at, is not only are things tight and tough now, but we're projected to be the worst in the country in terms of what we need. So if you fast forward from there and what we need and being tight, you know, why is this happening? How bad is it? Well, I have spent a lot of time talking about nurses just because that's the most dominant position. But if you look at that hole and you look at kind of what we're doing in state, you know, how are we doing at filling it? Our accredited nursing programs in Alaska produce about 324 RN graduates a year. All right? If you boil that down based on the numbers we've talked about, that's a supply of 324 nurses, new nurses, if they all stay in state, for a demand of we need 1,500 every year to provide services. 324 versus 1,500. That's a huge hole. Now, if you look at other priority positions, and again, this is in the report, but there's seven of them. Some of them are like respiratory therapists, CNAs, nurses. If you take seven of them, the top seven priority positions, and you look at what we're training here in Alaska, we only have capacity to train about 13% of the workers we actually need. So we have this massive deficit. And so what do you do when you have a deficit like that? Like lots of industries, we rely on non-resident healthcare workers. It's not uncommon in Alaska at all. 11.2% of our healthcare workforce back in 2021 were non-residents. Okay? That's about 5,000 people. The interesting thing about that is about 23% of them, almost a quarter, go on to attain residency. They stay. So what that means is, if we have four people coming up, whether they're travelers, temporary workers, we have a good shot at keeping one out of four. When you have the deficits we're talking about that I just talked about above, that's an important detail, especially when your supply is so short. What makes this so significant and an opportunity is healthcare in particular, when you look at all industries in Alaska, and I think we're somewhere on the lower end in relying on out-of-state labor, we have the highest non-resident to resident conversion in the state. Of all sectors. So that's important from a recruiting standpoint. While we don't want to go out of state, we want to have Alaskans fill jobs first, which they are because we have so many jobs to go around. The good news is when we do have to go out of state, we actually get to keep some people. And as I said, there are plenty of jobs to go around. There's no threat on taking someone's job. I'll remind you, 324 versus 1,500. We have a whole 1,500. So that's an important detail. I'm going to pause here for a second, and then we can keep going, but I wanted to see if there are any questions on anything we're touching on yet.
Mr. Kosher.
How many students are being turned away?
Through the chair, thank you, Senator Bishop. Great question. So I'm not trying to pick on University of Alaska. That's the biggest nursing program. But what I can say for them, the statistic is generally for every student they sit in an incoming class, they are turning away two candidates who have applied and would have been accepted to be in the program. So not two people that just put applications in, two people who would qualify, they would accept you tomorrow if they had the room. So for everyone we're sitting, we're turning two away.
So we could be graduating 660 if we had capacity.
Through the chair, yes.
Okay.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman. So it was suggested to me a few days ago by someone that perhaps nursing and other medical professions as well could move towards more of an apprenticeship model. You know, now we have people pay to become nurses, pay our university, and then you get to hire them. So I guess my question to you is are your member organizations willing to assist financially in that expansion to 600, whether it's at the university or somewhere else?
Through the chair, appreciate the question. virtually any question you ask about increasing the output of nurses in any position, we are going to say yes to. I mean, that's how bad this problem is. So the answer is yes. If we could be producing 600 nurses, you can still see we have a massive deficit still. I mean, there's so much room to go around. Of course we want to do that. And we're working with the university and other programs. Apprenticeships and that model has not been used in healthcare in a way that it should be, meaning we need to change our model to welcome that into the way we're doing business, because as you can see, there's just so much need. But to answer your question really directly, the big bottleneck on the education side are educators. It's impossible to find a nurse educator right now because you can make so much money in the field. There's no incentive to teach. And so you have a huge wait list of people who want to be in the program, but you don't have a huge list of faculty. And yes, we would absolutely support pooling resources and contributing to those resources to increase pay so that we can increase the class size. There's another limiting factor, having space for clinicals, making sure there's room in hospitals to run them through. And that's another thing that we would commit to making work. So to answer your question, we are a yes at anything we can do to help this problem, especially a local solution.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Okay.
Continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I had some really cool graphics, and they just got taken away from here. And I learned my lesson a long time ago on PowerPoint. You don't try and do those things where things pop up or you run into difficulties. And they've now all popped up in front of you. So that is unfortunate, but I'm going to go ahead and do this off the top of my head. What I was going to do is read through some bullet points and then have each of these headlines pop up and wow you, but there's no problem in doing this. What this is meant to show you is we're going to start talking about what are the consequences, okay? Who cares? You know, you got all these shortages. We hear it. Everyone's got these shortages. But what's the impact? And the impact is this. If you look in Alaska and look at our facilities and run by the positions, you know, how bad is it? How bad are the job boards? Are you really struggling? And if you go through some of the positions, you'll see, let's start with CNAs, for instance. If you look at the CNA position, which is the lifeblood of a nursing home, which also is critical for hospitals, they're running a 22% shortfall. And on top of that 22% shortfall, it's taken 108 days on average to fill a single position. On the nurse side, looking at just our hospitals and nursing homes, they're running a 24% vacancy rate on average over the course of the last year. And it took on average 161 days to fill the position. Respiratory therapists, I think it was a 38% shortfall. And then even sterile processing, cleaning the instruments, same type of range. So the point I'm trying to make is, not only, I spent a lot of time talking about RNs because we have a lot of good statistics on that, but these vacancies exist for everything. And all of that puts pressure. And it's one thing to have these vacancies, but then when you look at time to fill, the idea that it could take over 100 days to fill a single position, that's alarming. And the reason that's happening is, not only is it hard to recruit, not only is it hard to find these people, but once we find them, sometimes it takes a long time to get them licensed because of the licensing process. Sometimes it takes a long time to go through the background check. There are barriers after barriers, and that creates these delays, and these delays drive up those vacancies. And so what happens when you have that? You have limited staff, okay? We have vacancies across the line. They're everywhere. They're getting worse. And when you have limited staff, that means you have limited access. So we can have all, and this doesn't even have to be a hospital bed. You can think about a pediatrician's office. You can think about a community-based service. But I'll stick with hospitals because that's where we're from. If you have less staff, you can have all the beds in the world, all the rooms in the world. But if I have less staff, I can't use all those rooms, which means I am limiting my access. You can show up for your healthcare services, but I can't walk you to that room because it's not clean, or I don't have someone to give you services there. The problem with that is, with this limited staff meaning limited access, that means we have, you can almost say, especially on the nursing home side, you have less revenue coming in. Because, I mean, that's how we're set up in Alaska on a volume-based system, okay? It's fee-for-service. So in a nursing home, if you have less staff and you have to close units down because you can't see those patients. That means you have less revenue coming in financially. At the same time, when you have limited staff, it becomes more expensive. Why? Because you're paying more overtime, you're paying more incentive payments, you're burning your staff out, so you're doing more churn, so you got to replace them, and you're relying on more travelers when everyone else is doing the same thing. So you have lower revenue and you have higher expenses. And then on top of that, we have inflation, which means all of our supplies are going up. And you can imagine what that does to the equation. It leads to all of these headlines, which are clipped right from the newspaper over the last month. You have massive losses financially. You start to see closures. And if you don't see a closure, you're going to see consolidation. Consolidation is effectively a closure to different. And so you start to see these cracks and cracks. And the other thing you start to see is what's not talked about necessarily in the newspaper, and you'll see it's at the bottom there, and that's a snippet from an email. And it said, this Sunday we will have had a patient in-house waiting for long-term care for 1 year. Okay, that was a hospital reached out to us and said, we've had someone in our hospital for a year, and they've been waiting for long-term care. We can't get them out. Okay, well, yeah, that's sad. I get that. So what? They're in the hospital. They've been there for a year. They must need to be there, right? And the answer is no. They could have been discharged from that hospital for 365 days, but they sat. The reason they sat is because there was nowhere to place them. The reason there was nowhere to place them is because there's no availability in the post-acute environment. There's no staff to increase that availability. There's other issues in navigating the courts on supervision and custody and things of that nature. There's challenges on the Medicaid side and eligibility. All of this causes people to then get stuck in hospitals. And when this happens, if you don't need to be in a hospital, well, the hospital doesn't get paid for you to be there because you no longer meet criteria of care. So that person was in that hospital for 365 days, and virtually all of that care was uncompensated. Even though, you know, they're in their room, they're going to be rounded on by a nurse every single day, they're going to get their meals, which is the right thing to do, but all of that goes uncompensated.
Senator Bishop.
Jared, I'm not going to put you on the spot, but I just want to ask a question, and the chair's indulgence, and you want to get back to the committee. Just Providence, for example, or maybe, and you probably got this number cumulative for the association statewide. So you got a $1.1 billion loss for 22. If you were fully staffed, what would that be, zero and with a plus sign?
Through the chair, I'll speculate on that if that's okay. So that was clipped out of a national story. And so it was a cumulative number, and it was financial disclosure. And I would venture to say, of course, aside from inflation, supplies going up and all of those things, but I think it would be fair to say that, yes, if staffing was full and the volumes that were coming in could be taken care of appropriately, and then we had discharges happening as they should, then, yeah, I don't think you see those losses to that degree, and I do think they're positive. It would be tough to do that exercise, but I mean, that is how the model of care works. And when you have, unfortunately, in this situation, with not only do you have all these vacancies, and then you have the increases on traveler pay, bonuses, all that, on top of supply costs going up, it's kind of the perfect storm. But if you solve the staffing side of that and get rid of those vacancies, then yeah, I think it's a much different story for sure.
Just a comment, Mr. Chairman. I look at this healthcare shortage. To me, it's an apples and oranges, but it's in the same vein. It's no different than food security. If you were to have a mass casualty event in Fairbanks or Anchorage today, where are they going to go? So that's puts a little finer point on the severity of the issue.
Through the chair, we would echo the same sentiment, and that's the problem. It's if only it was so easy as, you know, whether you change a law or you change this or change that, but healthcare is complicated, and not only do we have these issues going on inside the facilities, but everything going on outside the facilities. our community-based services are not robust enough to support those discharges and placements, and they're suffering from worker shortages. And so that cascading effect, it's just a natural thing that happens. It pushes everybody to the hospitals. It becomes uncompensated. And then, you know, I said this at the beginning of the presentation, the cost of healthcare is too high. But well, why is it so high? Well, here's one reason. We're funneling everybody into the most expensive environment of care, because when there's nowhere else to go, where do you go? You go to the hospital.
Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman. Mr. Kosin, thanks for being with us today. You mentioned earlier in the presentation that there's a need for 7,500 new healthcare workers each year. Is that a product of just increased demand, or are these retirements, out-migration? Do you have a, you know, an answer to what might be causing that major increase in need?
Through the chair, that's a great question. It's a combination of all of those. It's growth. So growth in services needed, the aging population, which increases demand of services, and then, yes, worker churn with turnover rates. All of those things combined, really, so growth and churn. If you look at it seasonally over the, you know, a four-quarter period, which our report does, it shows how many people you have to funnel through to keep up with total jobs, and it comes out to that number. So it's all those factors together.
Thank you.
So I'm going to conclude shortly here and just kind of make some comments on, you know, we've kind of given you the numbers, we've shown the consequences, so what do you do about it? And I think it's important to be transparent and recognize that this is a long-term problem and it requires a long-term solution. And so when you're looking at how do you increase workforce, there's no snap of the finger. It's a process that's going to take 10 to 15 years to truly yield results. And so that requires focusing on kind of the workforce pipeline. How do you work with, you know, the question earlier about increasing faculty pay, increasing faculty, then increasing class size and getting rid of the backlog? That's a huge piece. How do you increase that output? How do you connect with younger Alaskans? I mean, how do you get to the classrooms, you know, first, second grade, and show them? You don't need to be a doctor or a nurse. There's so much more. To how do you create pathways? You have existing people who are really good at this stuff. How do you train them up? And that's the apprenticeships. That's the professional training, specialty training. And then perhaps the most important thing is our current workforce. How do you make sure they don't burn out? Healthcare's had a rough ride, and there's some dark stories out there. How do you keep people resilient and help them through and work on these wellness efforts?
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman. So something my colleague, Senator Bjorkman, has actually pointed out, I've heard him point out a couple times now, is that K-12 education in Alaska has been flat funded. And because of that, we've had to reduce the number of programs we offer to our students. And some of those programs were vocational programs and job readiness programs and the kind of things that I think would feed into what you're describing, a homegrown workforce. And so, you know, I don't want to completely put you on the spot, but what is your organization's opinion on increasing K-12 funding in the state of Alaska?
Through the chair, I thought you didn't want to put me on the spot.
Maybe I do.
Through the chair, I think it's a really good question. And I think since we are so healthcare focused and working at the broader problem, I think we would have to look at that specifically and talk as a group before I can really weigh in on something of that specificity. But as you can see, I think we really support robust education and creating our workforce in-house, because that's the only way to sustainably solve this problem.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Bishop.
I'll just put a little historical perspective on this. Back when I was the Commissioner of Labor, our 10-year forecast from your data, our data, our shops working together, we had it. From 2010 to 2022, we knew we had a 4,000 person gap. And last year, you and I had a conversation, it was 6,500. Today, a year later, it's over 7,000 person gap. So that just puts a little finer point on the need.
I appreciate that. Well, I'm going to end with one more slide, if I may.
Stop you for one okay. More question before we go on.
Of course.
To your knowledge, has there been some programs in Alaska ever that incorporated CNA training or other specific healthcare worker training at the high school level as part of a vocational program?
Through the chair, I'm not going to do it justice, and we'll, if I could, we could get you that information back to the committee, because there is a lot of work going around this. Our association over the last year has spent a lot of energy. I know a lot of individual facilities have been progressive in that, so we'll come back with information on that.
Excellent. Thank you.
For sure. So, well, I just told you the 10 to 15 year play and talking about those bigger concepts. We do get the question a lot from legislators. Well, what can I do? What's the ask? Well, what about the now? And I recognize, you know, the long-term stuff, there's a role for all of us, but really there, a lot of that is done outside the legislature. But if you want to do something now, something that would help is reciprocity. I talked so much about nurses and the shortages. And so we look at other states. Well, how are you doing with this? You know, we all have shortages. If you were to go back to that graph where I had with the bubbles on it and it looked like a bullseye, well, the reason that bullseye was in the middle is because it showed the amount of Alaska nurses per capita is in line with the national average. The problem is the entire country is short on nurses, and hence we are. So when you look at that, we're all suffering from this nurse shortage problem. And so you look at, how are people dealing with this? What are they doing to creatively try and attract people to their state? And one deterrent we have in Alaska is, right now it takes about 3 months to get a nurse license. Okay? And I hope I don't steal this story, but I have to. Even on the airplane today, I was talking to someone, and hopefully this is okay. But they were talking about how their niece was a NICU nurse. And I couldn't believe it. I was like, this is perfect. And her niece wanted to come up and work up here. Could be a traveler, full-fledged nurse, no problem. And then had a place to stay, had a car, all of it's all set up. And then found out it was going to be 3 months to go through the licensing process. No one can wait 3 months. And so she turned down the assignment. And if you know right now, NICU nurses are incredibly high demand, especially in the Anchorage area, our highest level of care. So that's a case in point, right? I just heard it on an airplane this morning. And so when you have a three-month process to get licensed, and you know that's a deterrent, the question is, how do you get people here faster? Because if you can get people here faster, you can reduce that vacancy rate. If you reduce the vacancy rate, you increase capacity, things start to flow. So how do you do that? Well, the question is, well, what are other states doing? If you look at other states, a vast majority of them, 39 states and jurisdictions, are doing reciprocity. They have enacted what's called the Nurse Licensure Compact, which essentially allows them to recognize a single license between all of those states. So if you're a part of this compact, any nurse from any of those states can get one license on practice across state lines. What it does is it changes the standards to get a license. They have uniform standards to be processed and approved for a license, but the practice of being a nurse is left up to the individual states. Enforcing the rules, the scope of practice, all of that stays with your individual state. But the standards for actually licensing and letting someone in your state, that becomes uniform. That becomes reciprocal. If we were to go to do this, we would take our licensing process, which takes 3 months, which turns away the NICU nurse I just talked about, and knock it down into a matter of a week or two. And that includes a background check. A background check and licensing standards that are more stringent than we require today, which means they're safer. If we were to join this, we think we would be able to get nurses in our positions faster, especially rural Alaska. That starts drawing down on vacancy, and it helps. It's not a cure-all, but it is an excellent tool that would make a big difference. And the reason I raise this, and I know it's been brought up in years past, over 75 organizations would tell you right now this would help. From the medical field, tribal, non-tribal, the aging population, local governments, this has widespread buy-in. And so I leave it today with the committee. You know, it's one thing to offer doom and gloom and walk you through the statistics, but I always know it's kind of leave someone with, hey, if you're interested in doing something, what would actually make a difference? This would make a difference for us. So I'll conclude here, Mr. Chair. I'm happy to answer any other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Kozin. Questions from the committee? Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. you said that 23.3% of non-resident healthcare workers go on to attain residency, which I think is fantastic. Do you think, should this nurse licensure compact go into effect, that there's any chance that nurses in Alaska will leave Alaska for part of the year, you know, when it's not so lovely out, you know, spend maybe the winters down south, so we might actually lose some folks for part of the year?
Through the chair, I think that's a great question. And it's interesting. Well, I guess for the other 39 states that joined it, they must not be as concerned. But I think it's a reasonable question to ask. And I guess my answer back would be there's already so much movement among travelers. People are coming and going. And so I don't see how this would somehow create some big mass out-migration. But the other thing I would offer is, as you guys know as legislators, we're always talking about trying things. Why don't we try this? I mean, this is something you can put in place and you can sunset after 2 years. See if it works. And if we truly have an out-migration, repeal it after a year. So if we're so afraid of it and that becomes a valid concern, then of course we'd want to do away with it. And the nice thing is we can. It just takes an act by you. So that would be our response, is we don't think that would be an overarching concern, but should it become reality, we could exit at any point in time.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman. This is actually not a question, it's a comment that this is a really interesting topic, but I assume there's going to be a bill that will be back here if someone brings a bill, and we'll have a much longer conversation about this. So I'm not going to ask you questions today, but please don't take that as an indication that I don't want to ask you a lot of questions. We just have other things on our agenda today.
Understood.
Thank you, Chairman.
Yeah, through the chair. Thank you, Senator. Yeah, and we hope there's a bill. Like I said, we're here to kind of give the policy and offer the ideas. And when I talk to my members and the number of calls I get about workforce licensing and background checks, we really hope there's a bill soon on this, because we think this is this would be big.
Mr. Kozin, when we talk about nurse licensure compact, I guess the problem that the industry is hoping that the compact would fix is reduction in the time it takes to license nurses. Are there other things, if this solution doesn't move forward, that the Board of Nursing can do, should do, to speed up nurse licensing in the state of Alaska? What else can be done? Are there other options out there?
Yeah, through the chair, or Mr. Chair, that is a really good question. I'm not the type of person that would usually say this, but we spent over a year asking that very same question. And we talked to nurses, we talked to the board, we talked to the state, and they answered very directly, no. There is nothing that could speed up licensure to this extent that we have identified from other states, certainly nothing that would be cost effective, and certainly nothing that could be implemented as fast. So I would say we have not found other levers to pull that could make a material difference. And this is what we have found and settled on.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Mr. Kozin. We appreciate your presentation and information that you've provided today. We'll take a brief at ease.
Thank you.
Commerce today. Could you please state your name and affiliation for the record?
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Karen McIntyre. I'm the Vice President of Workforce at South Central Foundation.
Very good. The South Central Foundation is an Alaska Native-owned nonprofit healthcare organization serving nearly 65,000 Alaska Native and American Indian people living in Anchorage, the Matsu Borough, and 55 rural villages in the Anchorage Service Unit. Incorporated in 1982 under the tribal authority of Cook Inlet Region, Incorporated, South Central Foundation is the largest of the SERI nonprofits, employing more than 2,500 people in more than 80 programs. South Central Foundation's vision is a Native community that enjoys physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual wellness. Its mission is to work together with the Native community to achieve wellness through health and related services. The organization has developed and implemented comprehensive health-related services to meet the changing needs of the Native community, support individuals and families on their wellness journey. South Central Foundation's first compact agreement under Public Law
93-638 began in 1984. Their compact agreement provided dentistry, optometry, community health representatives, and injury control services. A funding request to provide substance abuse treatment service was added in 1987. Gradually, South Central Foundation increased its compact agreement capacity within the Anchorage Service Unit so that by late 1994, it was administering nearly half the primary care services for Alaska Native people. The Alaska Native Medical Center opened its doors in May of 1997. Earlier that year, Congress had passed Public Law 105-83, which included a section that enabled Alaska Native people to obtain ownership and management of all Alaska Native healthcare services. In 1997, South Central Foundation completed the assumption of ownership and management of primary care and other programs located in the Anchorage Native Primary Care Center. Since the beginning of the assumption of services, South Central Foundation instituted significant philosophical changes and other changes in the design and administration of these programs. South Central Foundation instituted a total system-wide transformation of care, increasing the quality and adaptability of programs, and, more importantly, the accountability of providers and customers alike. Alaska Native people are in charge of designing and delivering this health care. Karen, thank you very much for joining us today. Welcome, and could you please begin your presentation?
Yes, thank you very much for the opportunity, Chairman. So South Central Foundation is a tribally-owned Native nonprofit. We're located primarily in the Anchorage area. I have worked at South Central Foundation for 26 years. I come from three generations working in healthcare, and I was born and raised in Anchorage, Alaska. My mother is from the Kuskokwim River and is Yupik, and my father, late father, was from the Pribilof Islands and is Unangan. And I'm a customer owner of the system. I come from the community. We help own and manage healthcare services, and we provide services to over 65,000 Alaska Native American Indian people, and we work with over 55 villages and community health centers, as well as co-manage the Alaska Native Medical Center with Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium in Anchorage, Alaska. SCF is one of the top 10 largest private sector employers. We have actually 2,700 employees. We have growth. As Jared had mentioned, that our employee, you know, we are growing our behavioral health services as well as our primary care services. And amassed, you know, most of those employees, of course, are in healthcare clinical fields with providers, nurses, certified medical assistants, but we also have large community behavioral health programs and clinicians, as well as frontline staff to help meet the needs of our customers and our communities. Like Jared had shared, everybody is having challenges with workforce here in Alaska and even in Anchorage, and recruiting is continuing to be an issue. And it is not for a lack of trying and not for a lack of partnering with other community hospitals and Jared to get people interested in healthcare field to continue to provide healthy communities. As mentioned, South Central Foundation's vision is a Native community that enjoys physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual wellness. And our mission is working together with the Native community to achieve health and related services. Part of South Central Foundation, we have a large primary care clinics in Anchorage. We have over 60 primary care providers in the Anchorage-Matsu Valley, as well as the largest dental clinic and behavioral health services for the community. Today, I'm going to help share a little bit about the challenges that South Central Foundation is facing and share opportunities that the state can implement to positively impact healthcare workforce, as well as answer any questions that you may have. So this is kind of SCF's workforce snapshot. As I had mentioned, we're the top 10 employer in the state with 2,700 employees, and we currently have 510 vacancies. Some of those vacancies are because of turnover. Some of them are because of growth. As I mentioned, it's not for a lack of trying. Turnover has been an issue. After COVID, there were many individuals who decided that they didn't want to work in healthcare anymore, or they wanted to be closer to family and move outside, that sort of thing. Historically, South Central Foundation has a great retention rate, and we have had a better retention rate than our local healthcare organizations, and now our turnover rate is 20%. And we've never experienced that in all the years that I've worked at South Central Foundation. People are excited to work at South Central Foundation because of the work that we do with the community to achieve, you know, wellness, as I had mentioned. But as of January 17th, we had 500 vacancies. And as Jared said, that does have an impact on services.
Very good. Karen, is it okay if we ask questions throughout your presentation, or would you like us to wait till?
Yes, thank you.
Very good. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Chair. This is a very quick question. That 2,700 employees, does that include ANMC, or is that separate from ANMC?
Thank you. Good question through the chair. That is separate from from ANMC. With ANM, Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, we're close to 6,000 employees.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's just specific to South Central Foundation. Thank you. Between 2020 and 2023, we experienced, you know, as I said, significant increase in turnover. We've been working and partnering with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, Providence, Alaska Regional, Jared as well, to think about ways that we can improve our retention rates and improve recruitment. And we meet on a regular basis to see how we can collaborate and when we can have campaigns that can ensure that we're providing good places to work, as well as ensuring that we have enough staff to meet the needs of our community. The hardest positions to fill are those providers and nurses. As Jared had mentioned, nursing, it continues to be an issue. Our nursing workforce at South Central Foundation is getting older and retiring, and we're not keeping up with the demand associated with what we need to provide good quality care at ANMC and in our community health centers. In addition to nurses, we have behavioral health, master level therapists, and dental hygienists that are also the biggest needs for our community. We also want to thank you, you know, for making a lasting improvements for the passage of HB 265 for telehealth pharmacy last year. That was very helpful for us as a community that provides services to 55 villages. So we appreciate that. Regarding recruiting and retaining licensed professionals, there continues to be opportunity. We coordinate, you know, with organizations in our communities to figure out how we can attract and retain, you know, train qualified people in order to provide good quality care. Alaska is a state of collaboration, so even though we provide services that are similar, we tend to work together to meet the needs of the community. So as specialists have been harder to harder to get to the state, we often have providers that work at all hospitals in Anchorage, and we collaborate in order to make sure that we can meet the needs of our customers. There's, as Jared mentioned, you know, part of the concern is the backlogs with the licensing division. And, you know, being able to partner and think of new ways to get individuals licensed quicker. It's not for the state lack of trying, as well as the state background check unit, because there's also vacancies within the state. And those positions are also not being filled to provide those services. If you go to the state background check unit website now, you'll see that right there that they're looking for people to apply for their jobs as well. But depending on the job that is filled, depending on the licensing board and when they meet, oftentimes it takes longer for individuals like dentists to get licensed within the state. So it does take 3, 6, 9 months sometime to get individuals licensed to meet the needs of our customer owners. Also, as Jared mentioned, it would be great if we had an opportunity to think about how we can do that differently and allow for people from the lower 48 to come to our communities to provide care with getting faster background checks and faster licensing requirements. Those backlogs continue to increase, and what that means for us in our community is it takes longer to have access to good primary health care or dental services within our community. In addition to the Anchorage area, we also have community health centers, and it keeps on, let me go back. There we go. Here's some, it won't stay on that slide, I'm sorry, that we have community health centers. Those community health centers are all across the state of Alaska. As I mentioned, one opportunity that we could think of is we'd like to talk about housing as well in rural communities. That's an opportunity. We'd like to take the time to also thank the governor for introducing the AHF Rural Professional Housing Program and the legislature for supporting it. As you can see, you know, we support community health centers and locations that need housing. I myself, after graduating from college, wanted to go work in a rural community where my dad was from and received a job, but there was no housing, so I couldn't go back to work in St. Paul. And here's a picture of our St. Paul Health Center that we provide services to. So being able to provide rural and housing for healthcare professionals in our communities that we serve continues to be an issue. In order to attract and retain professionals and healthcare professionals, we need to have housing in rural communities to provide those spaces so they can be there. Also, reducing administrative burden. And what we mean by that is catching up, you know, there's lots of hoops. You know, as Jared had mentioned, there's healthcare is complicated, it's technical. As an organization, we need to jump through those hoops, administrative burden of paperwork, background checks, forms to fill out in order to bill for services, in order to get licenses, in order to get their background checks. And it's important to keep in mind that those new requirements often have an impact on access to care and being able to provide care in a manner, as Jared had mentioned, that people do want to come home and they do want to work in their community, but oftentimes it's easier and without having to jump through all of the hoops in order to get those licenses, for example. Workload continues to be an issue. Like I said, for the state background check unit, it's not that they're not working really hard to get their work done, but there's not enough hours in the day for the amount of backgrounds that are coming through in order to provide care to our community. Talking about creating a pipeline, I want to share an opportunity regarding our apprenticeships and what we've done at South Central Foundation and what we hope to do and continue to be able to provide for our community. Our entry point or our pipeline, as Jared mentioned, it's important to create pipelines. We have a RAISE program that is a youth program to get people interested in working in healthcare, and it starts from age 14 to 18. And we've had 744 youth who've participated in that RAISE program. That RAISE program has awarded us individuals who have gone off to be nurses and even in healthcare support programs. I have somebody in our HR department is 30 years old, who's been working at South Central Foundation for 15 years, who's a benefits specialist. So it's an opportunity to figure out a new way to grow our own within our healthcare system. We also have several other entry points, an administrative support training program that allows for individuals with just a high school or GED to come into healthcare and get trained on how to answer phones, provide customer service. In our administrative support program, our current program has career pathways, as Jared had mentioned, that are important. I myself started at South Central Foundation many years ago as an admin support. Now I'm the vice president of workforce. We also have a dental assistant training program. That dental assistant training program allows for training as well as chair side to learn on the job. We still have a big need for dental assistants. Our training program is not enough based on the community need for that we need for dental. We also have a clinical degree program initiative. So the question earlier for Jared was, are you going to fund people to attend universities and to go through clinical degree programs? And at South Central Foundation, our board of directors are supporting Alaska Native and American Indian people in clinical training and paying their way all the way through school to graduation because we can't afford not to, because there's not enough need. So we are figuring out ways to grow our own clinical staff starting from the age of 14. In addition to apprenticeships, you know, we partner with universities and trade schools. We have community partnerships. There's state programs. There's ideas that we are looking forward to be part of the conversation and help from the state to help fund some apprenticeship programs in order to get people trained to meet the workforce needs. Vacancies continue to be an issue. Some of our biggest vacancies where we've kind of grown our own in our system are tribal doctors. We have a tribal doctor training program as well. We have community health aid training program that we partner with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium to get people from communities providing care in their community, as well as dental health aid and behavioral health aid programs. One of our biggest needs is certified medical assistants. It's an entry-level nursing-type position. There are opportunities, and there are a few places where people can get CMA training, but once they're certified, it's a great place to kind of grow into becoming a registered nurse or a nurse practitioner provider, for example. In addition, we also have opportunities for people to become chemical dependency counselors and managers and supervisors. So if you were to be employed at South Central Foundation and your entry point was through the RAISE program or through the administrative support program, we have career pathways, as Jared mentioned, to learn, to try new things, to gain competency, to go to school, and help fund those individuals to meet the needs of our community. What questions do you have?
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One issue I've heard in some other industries, actually it's an industry and a problem in the National Guard, is low-level barrier crimes. I'm wondering if, particularly with the community health aid, dental health aid, the sort of health aid path, have you run into that at all, where someone has, when they were a teenager, has, you know, a low-level drug conviction, for example, and now they are barred from doing these programs? Is that an issue that you run into at all?
Yes, through the chair. Thank you for that question, Senator Dunbar. That continues to be an issue. I think that with the state background check unit, we have an opportunity to apply for variances. So, but that process is lengthy. There's a long application, but if there's a youth who had trouble when they were 18 and they want to get into the healthcare, they can apply for variances and we can support them apply for variances. But oftentimes it takes 3 months and people can't wait 3 months to have a job. But there are opportunities and it is a concern. In addition to the state background check unit, there are, you know, if you work with Indian children, there's also the Indian Child Protection Act, and they don't have an opportunity for variances. So oftentimes there are people who have had life skills that we want to hire, and we just can't because of those burdens or things that happened 20 years ago.
Can I ask a follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Please.
Is that, so I assume the law you referenced, the Child Protection Act, is a federal law? So we wouldn't be able to alter it here. Is that the case with most of the barrier crimes you run into, or are there some opportunities where maybe we could change either the variance process or the underlying law, you know, crime of moral turpitude, I think it's called, at the state level?
Yes, great question. Thank you, through the chair. There That is a federal law. The state law and the variance background check unit, there are also barrier crimes. And this becomes an issue because if you were younger and if you want to have provide care in healthcare, if you have a background or if you have children that maybe have gone that you had to give up through OCS, that would also be a barrier. And there's barring conditions, and those conditions are often things that happened many years ago that are also a problem that are state around state focused, that are barriers to getting people hired who may have done something, you know, when they were young and OCS was involved, and now they can't work in healthcare.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions? Karen, your organization, are you involved in the child care space as well?
Thank you, Chairman, for the question. We're not involved in child care, but we do have a residential treatment center for youth.
Oh, very good.
Yeah.
That's all the questions I think the committee has. Thank you so much for joining us today in Senate Labor and Commerce. We look forward to talking to you more as we kind of continue to explore workforce issues here and issues that affect really this essential service that all Alaskans rely on at some point in healthcare. Our next meeting will be on Friday, January 27th. At that time, we will hear from representatives from the vocational and technical education community. As there is no further business to come before this committee today, this meeting is adjourned at 2:40 p.m.